Shmooze this evening is sponsored by the funding resources, Ellie Krieger, who has been very generous and very helpful to us. I'd like to thank him for sponsoring the Shmooze. The Gemara Menachos brings down an example of Schar Mitzvah. It brings a case, and it says, from here we see the reward that a person gets for a particular mitzvah. And this particular mitzvah is a mitzvah of tzitzit. Says the Gemara as follows: Ma'isa ba'adam echad shayazohir b'mitzvah tzitzit. There was a man who was zohir b'mitzvah tzitzit. Zohir means he was very careful and very involved in it. And despite the fact that he was involved in that mitzvah, shama shayazona b'karche hayam, he heard that there was a prostitute in some distant island, shenatelas dalad me'a zuhuvim b'schara, who receives 400 zuhuvim. 400 zuhuvim for her schar, a tremendous amount of money. Shigala arba mayas zuhuvim. He sent that amount of money, the kaval azman, and he set a time. He then traveled. When the time came, he went the distance. It was quite far. Kishigiyaz mano, when the actual time came, bav yashav al pesach. He went to the house of this zona, this prostitute. Nichnas ashivchasa v'amrula her. The maidservant went in and said, "Osa adam sheshigalach dala me'a zuhuvim, that man who sent you the money, bav yashav al pesach, he's here." Amrahi yikanes, she said, "Let him come in." Nichnas, the man entered. Hisilo zayin mitosos, she arranged seven beds, six made of silver, one made of gold, and between each of them was a ladder, basically an accession up. She sat on the very top. He took off his tzitzits and he went up to join her. As he's climbing up the ladder, he gets to the very top, and his tzitzits, which were way below on the ground, miraculously rise up and slap him 1, 2, 3, 4 times in his face. And the shamet, he immediately jumped to the floor. V'yashavla on the garbikarka, and he sat on the floor. Vafhi nishmasa, she also, when she saw what was going on, she also came down. Yashval gabi karka, she sat on the ground. Amrallah, she said, Gufa shorumi, in the name of the Roman emperor. Sheini minachasecha, I will not leave you until you tell me what mum, what fault did you see in me? Amrallah, she said, Ha'avoda shalor isi, ishi yafa kamoscha, the truth is, I've never seen a more beautiful woman in the world. El mitzvah achas shivanu Hashem elokeinu, but there was one mitzvah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, v'tzitzis shema. The name of that mitzvah is tzitzis. V'kasiv ba ani Hashem elokeichem shtei pamim. It says, I am Hashem your God twice. Ani yu sh'asid lifara. I am the one who's going to pay back. I am the one who's going to punish. Ani yu sh'asid lishalim schar. I am the one who's going to pay reward. Akshav nidam ala kedalat edim. These tzitzis appear to me like four witnesses. At which point she says to him, I'm not going to leave you until you tell me your name, the name of your city, the name of your Rebbe, and the name of your Beis Medrash. He wrote it down on a piece of paper, and he left. Says Gemara, she then took all of her wealth. Apparently she was quite wealthy. She divided it up. A third she gave to the Malchus, she gave to the Roman government, because that was the only way they would let her leave. A third she gave to Aniyim, a third she took with her. And she took with her those motzos, those beds. She came to the Beis Medrash of Reb Chiya, and comes to Reb Chiya and says, Rebbe, Tziva alai v'yasuni gioris, tell me what to do so I can become a gioris. Amalah, he said to her, Biti, Shema einecha nasata b'chamed atamidim, maybe you place your eye upon one of the students. Are you looking to marry someone? Hotziya ksav, she took out the piece of paper, miyoda, v'nosolo, gave it to Reb Chiya. Amalo Reb Chiya said, l'chi zike b'mekecha, go be zoche in your mekech. Even though she did not come to be megayer to marry, he saw Baruch HaKodesh. The Rishonim explained to us that this was a woman that was destined to him. She in fact was megayeris. And the Gemara says, in the end, those mitos, those beds that she took out for him, be'isser, she ended up taking out for him in heter, and they ended up getting married. And this is the Gemara. And what I'd like to do is ask what I consider the obvious question on this Gemara. When we talk about a man who's zahir b'mitzvah, There once was a time when a human being would take on a particular mitzvah. Some people took on tefillin, and some people took on various things. If a person takes on a mitzvah, that means it's his mitzvah. He specializes in it. He devotes a tremendous amount of effort and energy to it. It becomes his mitzvah. There are examples given in the Gemara. There are examples that are brought down from stories. A man who was Zohar b'mitzvah sitzitz, once his sitzitz ripped when he was in the forest and he wouldn't move. He wouldn't move for an entire day because he wouldn't walk Dalet Amos without tzitzitz. If the Gemara describes this man as a man who's Zohir b'mitzvah tzitzitz, a man who's careful in tzitzitz, that means he's a Baal Madrega. He's a person who's holding on a certain level. Not only that, he does a few unusual things. He sends a large sum of money. 200 zuz is the amount of a ksuba, approximately a year's worth of sustenance. He sends 400 zuzim, $50,000 or more, to some zona in the Karche Hayam, in the hinterwoods over there, some island. This isn't Mexico. He's sending money somewhere, and it was very unusual. So unusual that the shifcha said the prepay guy has arrived, the guy who sent the money ahead of time, because no one else did that. He sends the money ahead of time, he then shows up, and then all of a sudden, something very strange happens. And the tzitzit slap him in the face, and he says these words. He says, Hashem Elokechem. It says twice in Shema. And we have one mitzvah, and those words are said twice in Shema. Hashem who pays back the punishment, and Hashem who rewards. So here's the question. If this zona recognizes this person as a ben Torah, to the extent that she immediately asks, what yeshiva do you learn in? If he's a person who's zohir b'mitzvah tzitzit, he's a person who's holding in Madrega. He's a person who's growing, who's accomplishing. How is it possible that he goes about doing this kind of thing? We're not talking about a momentary lapse. We're not talking about a sudden lust. We're talking about planning, traveling for weeks, sending money ahead of time, planning out an entire event. And the question is, what was he thinking? And if you don't appreciate this question, I'd like to share with you what the Sfas Emes says on this Gemara. He says, do you know what it means that he was Zohir b'mitzvah tzitzis? The Pasuk says, Uri'isem oso, you should look at tzitzis. Why? Because they remind you of the mitzvahs. Explains the Sfas Emes, it's an anaf, it's a branch to the next part of the Pasuk, that lo sasuru acharei einechem, don't be pulled after your eyes. There is a specific lo sasay in the Torah, not to be pulled after what your eyes see. This man was zahir, was careful, meticulous to always look at his tzitzits, meticulous to be careful in that mitzvah. So how is it possible that this guy goes through this entire scenario, sends the money ahead of time, goes through weeks of travel, goes through months of whatever is involved in it, and then suddenly something changes and all of a sudden he's a different man? The question is, what was he thinking and what changed? What was actually happening in this person's life? And to answer this, what I'd like to do is do something that we rarely do. And that is try to understand how we function. Try to understand the human on a very fundamental level. We spend a lot of time living, but we spend very little time analyzing ourselves, trying to really understand ourselves, and self-knowledge is something that's typically rare. Step number one, when Hashem created us, Hashem put us on a planet to grow, to accomplish. Hashem took a pure, brilliant neshama. There's a part of me that sees from one end of the earth to the other. There's a part of me that only wants to do what's good, what's right, what's proper. There's a part of me that so desires a relationship with Hashem. That is a full half of the I whom I'm speaking to you. However, to give a person bechira, to give a person an actual challenge, Hashem put that neshama and mixed it with the nefesh habahami. The nefesh habahami, which we've spoken about before, is similar to any nefesh that you'll find anywhere in the animal kingdom. Every animal has a nefesh, has an instinctual, natural part to it that keeps it alive, that all of the instincts, drives that are needed to keep it alive and bring about the next generation. The dog instinctively does many things. The baboon instinctively hunts, sleeps, eats, procreates all of the desires needed to keep it alive and bring the next generation into existence, Hashem implanted into the nefesh habahami of every animal in the animal kingdom. The I who am speaking to you also have a nefesh habahami. There's a full half of me that is utterly, completely instinctual, completely driven only by appetites, by instinct, by momentary impulses. A full half of me is a nefesh habahami. And the reason why this is essential is because only when you focus on this can you begin to understand this complex wonder called I. How is it that sometimes I could be speaking to Hashem literally right there, being medaber lifnei HaMelech, speaking to my Creator, having conversation, and then 5 seconds later, I'm gone. I'm 3,000 miles away, and I don't wake up until I take 3 steps back, and where am I? How is it that sometimes I'm kind, I'm good, I'm generous, and sometimes I'm a creep? But I'm not a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'm not some psychopath. I'm a normal, functional human being. And because I'm a normal, functional human being, catch me in the right mood, I'm kind, I'm generous, I'm good. Catch me in the wrong mood, and I'm nasty. And if you're honest with yourself, you'll quickly find that we human beings do some mighty contradictory things. And we're not so comfortable with it. The reason we're not so comfortable with it is because there is a pure neshama within me that says, how could you do something so selfish? How could you not be concerned for another Jew? How could you not help that person? And why are you so self-centered? And there's another part of me that says, because I want to be, and I just don't care. And I can't care about anyone but me. It's me, me, and no one else. And the I whom speaking to am comprised of both. And that is the Anochi. The I who am speaking to have two diverse elements, two completely opposing parts. And the battle of life is which one comes to the fore and which one vanquishes the other, but the two are constantly battling. One or the other reaches primacy. But that alone would never allow for Bechira. If Hashem created us with a pure neshama and all of the instincts of a nefesh habahami of an animal soul, you and I would not have free will. Why? Because the neshama is brilliant, perceives and understands the consequences. I do not drink bleach. If you were to offer me $1,000, I wouldn't drink bleach. I don't do heroin. If you offer me $10,000, I wouldn't do heroin. It sounds nice. People describe it as wonderful, pleasurable, etc. But it's damaging to I would never do it. Why? Because I'm not foolish. So if Hashem were to take the nefesh habahami and mix it with the nefesh hasichli, you and I would not have free will. Why? Because there'd be a clear voice within me that says every action that you're engaged in imprints upon you for eternity. Every time you're kind and you're sweet, you're shaping yourself into what you'll be forever. Every time you act selfish, you're damaging yourself. And I might have instincts, I might have desires, but I would never give in to them. Because I would see the future so clearly, and I would see the results of these actions right in front of me, and I wouldn't have free will. So to allow a human being to have actual free will, Hashem, if it could be, added another dimension to the human. And that dimension is something called imagination. Dimyon. Dimyon is these flights of fancy, these fanciful imaginations, where I get caught up in whatever it is. If you read a novel, or if you've watched a play, and you're right there, it could be the 17th century, I'm a pirate, swashbuckling, fighting on the deck. And then someone calls you to dinner, and oh, gone is the sword, gone is the boat. But when you were reading that book, it was real. And if you're not sure that I'm right, women especially, tell me if it's not true, have you ever cried when reading a novel? How could you cry? It's a book. It's a made-up story. You know it's a made-up story. It's words on a page. What are you crying about? I'd like to share with you why you're crying. Because you're in that story. And when that event is happening, it's not happening to the heroine in that story. It's happening to you. You're in that story, you're in those events, and the reason you feel it is because you've taken a flight of fancy. You've taken a leap of imagination, and you feel it, you're margish it, and it feels real. Now, is it real? No, it's not real, but is it? It's not, it is, it's not, I'm not really sure, but it's sort of right there in between. And now, with this thing called imagination, a very interesting thing happens. The human being now has actual, real free will. And I'll explain to you what I mean. Muhammad Ali was once on a plane, and after a few announcements about please fasten your seatbelts, please fasten your seatbelts, and he didn't fasten his seatbelt, and the flight attendant and the stewardess in those days came over to him and said, sir, would you please fasten your seatbelt? Superman don't need no seatbelts, answers Muhammad Ali. To which the stewardess, without missing a beat, said, Superman don't need no airplane. At which point Muhammad Ali fastened his seatbelt. Now, I'd like to ask you a question. If you were to go over, Mr. Ali, sir, do you sincerely believe that you're Superman? I mean, do you mind if I pull out a gun and put a few bullets in your chest because after all, they're balanced because you're Superman? He knew he wasn't Superman, really, right? Well, he did, but sort of not when it comes to sort of little decisions like buckling a seatbelt, because I'm Superman. Come on, you're not Superman. Well, sort of I am. And if it sounds strange, human beings believe things all the time. We believe these little steps, flights of fancy, and they become very imaginative. And because we do that, we're able to do things that are very strange and very unusual. Let me share with you a very interesting example. When my wife had her first child, she put on some weight, and she was very concerned with this, and she went on what I call the SIT diet. The SIT diet, I think some of you may be familiar with it, the SIT diet is a self-inflicted torture diet. It consists of the following. You take a wedge of chocolate cake. You take a Diet Coke. In this hand, you hold the Diet Coke. In this hand, the fork. You say the words, I'm so fat, I'm so fat, I'm so fat. You consume the entire wedge of chocolate cake and drink the Diet Coke. Now, my wife is a very sharp, very intelligent woman. In fact, one of the smartest women I knew. And after we had our first child, she went on the SIT diet. I said, oh, no. I said, listen, if you want to be heavy, I'm fine with that. You want to be slim, I'm fine with that. But no self-inflicted torture diets, please. Anyway, it lasted a few weeks, and finally I said, that's it. We're going to Weight Watchers. And I took my wife to Weight Watchers. Now, this was a few years back. I was still in Colo at the time. It was uncommon then to have a man show up at Weight Watchers, but I showed up. The only man in the room. Now, you have to appreciate the fact that everyone there was there for a reason. And everyone there very much wanted to lose weight. And I got to watch an experience. This is basically what happened. The leader got up and said, okay, ladies, what happened this week? And one woman raised her hand and said, well, I was doing real great, and then somebody brought out chocolate cake. Oh, chocolate cake! The moan goes around the room. Another woman says, I was doing great, and then someone brought to work potato chips. Oh, potato chips! Another woman says, donuts. Oh, donuts! And I was watching these grown women lose it right in front of my eyes. And I said to myself, aha, isn't that interesting? Here's the question. Madam, you've made a decision, a cognitive, intelligent decision not to eat chocolate cake. So just don't do it. Oh, she made that decision. The wise, rational part of her made that decision until the chocolate cake came out. I'm not gonna touch a bite. Yes, you will.
No, I won't.
Yes, you will.
No, yes, no, yeah.
And this woman was in total, complete contradiction, in stira, in a fight, which she lost. And then moaned about it in front of the group, and everyone understood exactly what she was saying. The reason why I share that with you is because I found that profound. Because I was a yeshiva guy for many years. And that was something that any Ben Torah experiences on a regular basis. And this was the first time I went into the world and found that other human beings experience it, albeit in a limited manner, albeit in a small way. But that battle where I absolutely, completely have decided that I will not do something, And on the other hand, I absolutely, completely want it. I do and I don't, I do and I don't, I don't. And I'm in contradiction. And sometimes I win and sometimes I lose is the battle of life. Weight Watchers is interesting, but life is about that battle. But those two voices alone, you have to focus and understand, why is it that we lose these battles? You see, here's the question. If you'd ask one of these women, tell me, do you have a problem fasting? No. Do you have a problem eating before Kiddush? She won't touch a piece of chocolate cake until her husband comes home to make Kiddush. So clearly you have control. Clearly you're not out of control, so why can't you just not eat it? So I'd like to share with you the why behind it. The why behind it is, when something is forbidden, it's forbidden. When something is sort of, I'm not sure, it becomes a major, major fight. And if you'd like to know where imagination fits into the picture, it's in two realms. Imagination comes in when we have something called Mora Heter. Now, since the time you're a little child in Cheder, you knew that Mora Heter meant that the Yetzirah would tell you that this act is permitted. But I'd like to share with you that it's not actually how it works. It's much, much more subtle than that. Let me share with you what I mean. I had a conversation with a young man recently who called me up. We were pretty close, and we had been speaking during his engagement, back and forth, etc. And recently, after about 3 weeks of marriage, he calls me up, and he says, you know, I'm very happy, Baruch Hashem, she's a great girl, but she's not frum. I said, what do you mean? I mean, I knew very different things about her, but she's not frum. I said, what do you mean? He said, listen, we were in great adventures, and it was difficult to wash, so she took out a bagel. She didn't wash, she just ate the bagel, just like that. She's not frum. I mean, it's strange, he says, because she's so careful about Lashon Hara. She gets so upset if I say anything remotely near Lashon Hara, but washing she doesn't care about. She's not frum. Okay, I said to him, that's an issue. And I said to him, I'll bet you that she's on the phone right now with her kala teacher saying he's a great guy and all that, but he's not frum. I mean, yeah, he won't won't touch a bagel without washing, but Lashon Hara, he speaks all the time. And would you like to know why it is? Because as strange as it sounds, we have two Shulchan Aruchs. There's a Shulchan Aruch that stays in the Beis Medrash, and there's a Shulchan Aruch that comes with us. You know, kind of like the Melech. The Melech had one Sefer Torah that he kept in his palace, one Sefer Torah that went out with him. We too have two Sifri Torah. We have the Sefer Torah in the Beis Medrash, and then we have the one that we take out with us. And the one that we take out with us is very flexible and very, very malleable, changes at will, changes at the slightest whims. And it's a very strange thing to watch it change right in front of your eyes. And I'd like to share with you just one example of what I'm referring to. This was a Maisa Shahaya. A fellow had a job in a frum office. Many frum people were working there. There was a little kitchenette. He brought in milk for his coffee. He brought it in a container. And he found, by the time he got to his coffee break, there was no milk left in the container. Somebody stole his milk. The next day he brings in a container and he puts a sticker on it. Makbid, please do not take my milk. And by the time he comes to his lunch break, the milk is gone. That's it. The next day he comes in with a sticker. This is Gezel, Gezel Gomer, I am Makbid. It is stealing. You have no rishus to take my milk. He puts that on the container, knowing full well that this time when he comes out for lunch, his milk will be there. Lo and behold, he gets there, the container is empty. He is so frustrated, the next day he comes in and writes the word Chalav Stam on the container, and lo and behold, the milk was there by lunchtime. Now, I'd like to explain to you why that was. Chalav Stam, I guess it's Chalav Stam. I won't drink Chalav Stam. What do you think, my guy? What's your problem? I won't. I mean, taking somebody else's milk with permission, not permission. Come on, that's like just a little, you know, that come on. That's not us, sir. That's, I mean, I know I shouldn't do it, probably, you know, but come on, not really. Chalav Stam is mamish and iser. And doesn't that sound cute? Well, let's share with you, it's not so cute. One of the GPS settings on my car is for Otisville. Otisville Federal Penitentiary, minimum security federal penitentiary, because I've gone there a number of times already. And I'll explain to you the first time I went there. The first time I went there to visit someone, I came in, and while I was waiting for that person, someone else asked me, "Oh, Rabbi Schaefer, do you remember me?" "Oh, you were my high school shiur." "Yeah, Baruch Hashem." Otisville is a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. 3 minyanim a day, 2 daf yomis. The guy steig there. It's a tremendous opportunity to take a year or 2 or 3 off and grow. It's a beautiful, wonderful opportunity. And I can't describe the Chilul Hashem when I walk in there and see a guard and I see not a couple, but a number, 30, 40 or more frum inmates. Frum guys are not supposed to be in prison. And don't get me wrong, some of them don't belong there. There are some cases where they're framed or whatever, but many of them belong in a lot worse. Many of them belong in maximum security, maybe for life. And you wonder, how could it be? The guy's frum, he davens, he learns. Maybe he can get to the shiur. There is a good shiur, a couple of good shiur given there because the guys know how to learn. And you say, what's pshat? I'll share with you what's pshat. If I do it, it's mutter. You know what nasalok keheter means? It doesn't mean that I took this avera and made it mutter. It's usser, I know it's usser, but for me, a little different. You know, for me, whatever. I'm not saying it's a great mitzvah, I'm not saying it's wonderful, but for me, it's different. And if you think it's just criminals, and if you think it's just other people, I'd like to share with you that we do it all the time. We all have 2 Shulchan Aruchs. We have a little Shulchan Aruch that we keep in the Beis Medrash, and we have a Shulchan Aruch that we take with us out into our own world. And how do I know that I'm right? What happens when you come Yom Kippur and you start clapping Al Chetz? Al Chetz Yechatan Levanecha, Al Chetz Yechatan Levanecha, Al Chetz. And you say to yourself, what? Me? I have no connection to that. I mean, let me think. Did I do an Aveira this year? Maybe. And if you're candid and you do a real cheshbon and nefesh, how many of us really see that we have averas that we have to really do tshuva for? I mean, I'm not a tzaddik. Obviously, I must have done something wrong. So tell me them. Give me the list. Tell me those averas that you've done. And if it happens to be that you can tell me some, that means because you have an area of weakness that's so blatant that you're aware of it. But otherwise, I guarantee you fall and pray to the Nasalo Keheter. It's okay, I'm okay, and there's a very specific reason for that. You see, to allow for Bechira, Hashem gave us this ability to create fanciful imaginations because the neshama within me would scream out, what are you doing? Do you know what Lashon Hara means? You're damaging another Jew's reputation. You're hurting their parnasa. You're hurting the way people look at them. What do you mean you're selfish? How could you do that? And if I couldn't paint this elaborate, colorful picture, then what would happen would be I would have no free will. And to allow for Bechira, Hashem gives us this koach called Dimyon, that we can paint pictures and come up with the most elaborate, fanciful stories and actually believe them. And they sound credible until you tell them to a jury of your peers. Try one of your very good stories and try telling it to a friend. You would never tell it because you'd be embarrassed like all get up. And my friends, I'd like to share with you that's pshat in this Gemara. This was a man who was zahir b'mitzvahs, that means he was steiging, he was growing, he was learning, and he was very careful to be nizar in ureisim oso, so he shouldn't be involved in estaklis, he shouldn't look at women. And he sends 400 zuzim to this prostitute in Karchei Hayam, in some island over there, and he goes for weeks. Why? Because this is different. This is me. I'm not saying it's a mitzvah, but this is me, and it's okay, and it's, you know, and I've done it once, if I've done it twice, if I've done it 3 times or 4 times, it's nasa lo keheter, it is okay. I'm not saying in Shulchan Aruch it's okay, I'm saying for me it's okay, And a very strange thing happened to this man. Because he was on such a madrega, explains Rashi, he had a nace, literally a miracle. He was up on the top bed. His tzitzits were down on the floor. His tzitzits flew up, smacked, 1, 2, 3, 4. And you know what happened to this man? He woke up from his slumber. He got it. What a fool. What was I thinking? I was believing this nonsense, this utter stupidity. What was I thinking? And when you read about these type of things, you say, it's strange, how could it be? Obviously, it's not me. And my friends, I'd like to share with you, it's us, and it happens all the time. And there's only one solution. The only solution is to be critically honest, to ask yourself, where am I headed? What's my life about? To do a cheshbon nefesh on a regular, constant basis. And if you're not taking time to analyze your life, if you're not taking time to ask yourself, where am I headed? What am I doing? Are my actions in line with my goals? If you're not setting time to set real goals and then ask yourself if I'm in line with them, you may find yourself in a very, very strange place. One of the reasons, and maybe even the main reason why Hashem gives us a Yom Kippur, gives us Yomim Neroim, is an ability to bring ourselves back to course, to find where we've gone wrong, to reset our course, because that's the main focus. Yes, it's about Slicha, yes, it's about Kapara, but more than anything, it's about taking stock, about asking myself, why am I here? What are my goals? What do I aspire to? Where do I want to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now? And are my actions in line with my beliefs? Am I leading the kind of life that I should be? Well, of course I am, right? I'm busy, I'm doing, right? I'm a Ben Torah, I'm a firm guy, I learn, and I'm a firm woman, I do everything I should, right? I'd like to share with you that if you don't take stock, if you don't on a regular basis check yourself, you're going to find yourself in a very strange place. And I'll give you a very interesting example of just that. If you ask social scientists, if you ask economists, what was the single greatest invention in the past 1,000 years, maybe in the course of history, most people will tell you the printing press. The printing press revolutionized knowledge. The average person in the 1300s didn't own a book. A book had to be handwritten. So almost every home in Europe didn't have books because they were too expensive. The printing press changed all of that. Who invented the printing press? A fellow named Gutenberg. He spent 10 years planning it because he had to invent 3 different types of technologies. He had to invent the press itself. He had to invent movable type. He then had to invent a specific type of ink that actually would stick to paper under those circumstances because no one had done this before. And after 10 long years, he was ready to launch his endeavor to now introduce the printing press to the world. He took out a sizable loan, he opened his shop, and he began printing. And initially, he did quite well. And the church hired him to print out leaflets, but he wasn't satisfied with that. He decided he was going to change the world, he was going to revolutionize the world, he was going to print the first Bible, and in fact, he did. The Gutenberg Bible was the first printed Bible. He printed 200 copies of this Bible, and then he ran out of money. No money left. He sold the press, sold the ink, sold the movable type. He ended up working in the shop, and the great Gutenberg, who changed the world, was a pauper. He spent the rest of his life as a worker in the shop and benefited not at all from his invention. Why? Because he had a brilliant idea, but no business plan. A brilliant idea that changed the world, but no step-by-step plan of how I'm going to succeed. And I believe that's actually a mushel for life. You could be a wonderful person with a tremendous background. As a guy, you could have spent many years in yeshiva learning. As a woman, you could be a real Yerushalayim. But if you don't have a very real plan for your life, if you don't have a real plan in 2 years from now, in 5 years from now, in 10 years from now, this will be me, I almost guarantee that you're going to be 2 years older, 5 years older, not that much different, And you never know where you're going to be, because there's no plan, no direction, no taking stock. Where am I holding? Are my actions in line with my belief? And you'll find yourself slipping and slipping and slipping and slipping, 2 years older, 5 years older, and you'll find yourself waking up in some strange situation that you never believed you would be in. And if you're not sure that I'm right, I'll share with you one very clear example. And this is not the only example, and I don't want to limit it to this, but this is an obvious example. One of the great challenges of our world today is the challenge of dealing rationally, intelligently, prudently with technology. And technology has many, many costs to it. Woe to the person who goes on an internet site without a filter. Woe to the person who just allows his children to surf the web. And I trust my kids because my kids are good kids that I brought up well, and I don't have to worry about them. You know the war stories. I'll share with you one only because it happened to me, so I know about it. I get a call from a fellow in England. All's a tumult. We've spoken before on certain issues, but this is a big deal thing. Normally we communicate by email. He's got to speak to me. Tremendous problem. What's the problem? His son went to his cousin's house. And when his son came back, the father found out that the son was watching with his cousin on the iPad. They're watching pornography. Okay, now that's a problem. But folks, let's be real. This is the 21st century. What does he have to call me all the way from England for? What's the big deal? The big deal was the age of the boys. They were 7 years old. Now, when you're 7 years old and you're exposed to that type of stuff, it's a very real problem because you don't even have the, forget the emotional maturity. You don't understand these things. You don't have, it's a very real problem. So I think at this stage in the game, most of us are wise enough. If we haven't fallen ourselves, we have plenty of friends or plenty of children that we know who have fallen. So I think most of us are wise to the fact that you have to be very careful, and you can't allow yourself, you can't allow your children, you can't allow your spouse to be in front of an internet unless there are huge, huge security measures as much as you can. And even that is not a guarantee, but you have to do what you can, because if not, you're going to find yourself. And how many guys have found themselves on a site or whatever doing things that they never dreamt that they would do, being involved in things that they never dreamt about? And folks, it's not limited to men. It's women as well. You hear the war stories all the time about good from women end up somewhere, whatever. Okay, that's a challenge, but that we're aware of. But the challenge doesn't end there. I'd like to share with you Rosh Yeshivas that you may not be aware of. Beis Lamed Vav Gimel. Beli Emes Ugvul. Without any truth and without any limit. Those are the Rosh Yeshivas. There's something called blogs. Beli Emes Ugvul, without any truth and without any limits. Go to a blog and listen to the, I can't call it banter, the vile stuff that comes out. Lashon Hara, destructive words, but such chutzpah, such audacity. So I only have the best filters on my computer. I would never go to a site that's not kosher. And you'll see men and women involved on blogs spending hours of their life every day, wasting hour after hour in Lashon Hara and every imaginable issue. And that's something to be aware of. But I believe there's a third problem that we're not as sensitive to. The American Psychiatric Association came out with the DSM-4, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. So in it, they have descriptions of different mental disorders. One of the mental disorders that are clearly laid out in the DSM-4 is something called ADHD. Anyone ever hear of that? Anyone have it? Okay. ADHD has three manifestations: distractibility, impulsivity, and hyperactivity. But listen to the first two. Distractibility, and impulsivity. Have you ever watched someone with a smartphone? I've watched guys with their kids in the park with a smartphone over here, cute little kid, a gorgeous little kid, he's on Facebook. What are you wasting your life for? He's so distracted, so impulsive, and that's what it's training you to do. It's training you in impulsivity, it's training you in distraction, and if you don't think I'm right, they've done studies now. They've done brain scans that show that the more you're exposed to this, the more those parts of the brain that control or don't control impulsivity and distractibility grow, and we are a generation of ADHD. The screens we sit in front of, the smartphones that we sit in front of, are constantly bombarding us with new and more irrelevant, foolish nonsense, and constantly distracting us from anything meaningful and significant. And if you don't think it destroys families, I'd like to share with you, it does. It destroys your brain, destroys your show and bias, destroys your kids, destroys what you're here for. And I have a concept that I'd like to share with you. The concept is that on the phone, there is something called the off button. Now, I know this is radical. I know this is wild to say, but you are permitted. You can quote me on this. You are permitted to push the off button and shut the phone off. You know when you're permitted to do that? When you're in the base medrash. You know when you're permitted to do that? When you come home from work. You know when you're permitted to do that? When you're at the supper table. You know when you're permitted to do that? Anytime you want. And you know why you should do that? Because you value your life. And if you'd like to stop being distracted and impulsive and pulled and not be there, shut the phone off. Stop it. It may sound funny, but I've seen it again and again. People are talking to their wives or their children, and they answer the phone or they answer the email. Listen, folks, I am a human being living in the 21st century, and I had a BlackBerry, and on the BlackBerry was my email. And I'm sitting in my office with a man who's telling me his life saga, and it's a tough one. And first he starts with Rabbi Shiva, thank you so much for taking the time. I know your time is very precious. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And he tells me his saga, and he says, I appreciate that you take time for me. And about an hour into his saga, he gets an email, in response to the email. And then he goes back to his woes and his troubles and his worries, and he gets another email, and he responds to it. And it happened the third time. And I said to him, thank you very much. Because of you, I made up to take my email off of my BlackBerry. Because I saw a man who literally has no life. A man who's so drawn into it, who's so impulsive, so just there, that he lost any sense of balance, any sense of life. And my friends, I don't want to sound radical, but I think it's time that we did some serious cheshbon nefesh. How much has technology helped us? How much has it hurt us? And believe me, I'm not one who's going to tell you, don't ever go on the internet again. Theshmooze.com exists on the internet, so I can't exactly ban it. And there are tremendous benefits from the internet, and there are tremendous, tremendous costs. And if you'd like to grow, you'd like to accomplish, you have to stay balanced, you have to stay focused. And one of the things you should be thinking about on Yom Kippur is, how am I using my time? Am I controlling technology? I heard it once said that every Rav needs a technology gabbai. He needs a gabbai to tell him all the latest and the greatest and the ways to avoid it. And every one of us needs a cheshbon nefesh. How are we using our time? What are we accomplishing? And specifically in this area of technology, am I careful enough? Is it a tool that I'm using, or is it destroying me? And again, it destroys in so many ways. My friends, I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from this Gemara. You could be a man who's zohir b'mitzvahs, a man on a very high madrega, a man who's a real ben Torah to the extent that the Zohar says, what yeshiva are you learning in? He clearly was a ben Torah. A man who Chazal defined as zohir in a mitzvah, and as the Sfas Emes explains, constantly looks at his sitzes and does something so strange. How could it be? How could it be? Because that's called free will. You see, when Hashem created us, it was with two voices inside. a pure neshama and a nefesh abahami, and the two are fighting all day, every day. And that fight is the purpose in life, to be mezgaber, to win. But the fight isn't just two voices. It's not just, do I want the chocolate cake, do I not want the chocolate cake? There's a whole other part, this whole other fanciful thing called imagination that allows us to take everything that's forbidden and make it permitted and eventually make it a mitzvah. When this man set out on that week-long journey, three-week-long journey, he wasn't doing an avera. He was involved in something that, listen, for me, under these circumstances, you know, I need a break, I need a little time off, so this is okay. And if that sounds strange, we human beings do it all the time. Maybe not in that area, but look at people who steal, look at people who lie, who cheat, look at people who speak Lashon Hara, look at people who, like you and me, do various things. And what you'll find invariably is we have fanciful svaras, beautiful logics to explain what we do. And every once in a while, it hits like a thunderbolt. If you'd like to know one of the purposes of Yom Kippur, it's to stop the static. Stop the busyness. Look at your life with clear, focused eyes and ask yourself, am I happy with me? Am I leading the life I want to lead? Have I set goals that I'm happy with? Am I accomplishing those goals? Am I doing what I was put on the planet for? And every year a person has to recalculate their course, reset their course, ask themselves these questions, and that's one of the main focuses of Yom Kippur. But to do that, you have to step out of your own world. You have to step out of the busyness, and step out of what you're doing. You have to shut the iPhone off and dumb down the technology. And by the way, smartphones we might be much better off with dumb phones. And I'm right now on the edge of considering that exact move. Because as smart as my phone is, my question is, how much is it helping me? And again, my friends, it's not just the phone. It's the phone, it's a screen. And by the way, if you're not sure that I'm right, anyone here know a teenager? Studies show that the average teenager today sends approximately 4,000 texts a month. There are 30 days in a month, about 125 a day. If they're up for 12 hours, that means 10 an hour. Uh-huh. That means all day. I heard an interesting Shaila, right? I heard Rabbi Wallerstein, he's speaking here. I heard his Shaila, when the chasen and kallah under the chuppah, do they have to say Arayat Mekadeshes? Or can he text it? You know, yes, I'm a kallah, right? Because that's how teenagers communicate. Okay, it's interesting, but it comes at a cost. And one of the things that we need to do is constantly ask ourselves these questions. What am I doing? How am I living my life? How is my family leading my life? And one of the reasons why we stop the busyness, one of the focuses about Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, is to take stock, to look back at the past year and ask myself, what am I happy with and what could I do to change? What areas am I going to do differently? What areas am I going to change? And the ability to pierce through the lies, the ability to look at my own excuses and pierce through it and see the truth is something that requires a lot of work. Let me finish with a story that I find very compelling. Aaron Rolston was an outdoorsman. He was a hiker, biker, young fellow, he was about 27. He lived not far from Utah, and often he would take his bike and ride out for miles and miles and then go hike for a day, sleep out in the wilderness there, and come back. In any case, one day he went on just such a journey, took a 30-mile bike ride, and then went for a long hike in some remote place in Utah. And he's sort of climbing into a cavern, some sort of like almost huge, huge ditch. And he describes that as he was stepping down, there was a stone that was wedged between two sides of this canyon. And as he stepped down, it was an 800-pound boulder, somehow he dislodged it. He fell down, and the boulder fell and jammed his hand against the canyon wall. There he is with an 800-pound boulder jammed, broke his wrist and his hand, jammed against the wall, and he can't get out. He has no cell phone. He has about a day's worth of water, almost no food, and a pocket knife. And he's stuck. He can't scream because there's no one within miles and miles. He's not expected back for a number of days, and even when he's found missing, no one knows where he is. He's stuck. And he figures out every possible way to get out. First, he tries to contrive some sort of pulley system to pull the rock up. Then he tries to chip away at the rock. He conserves his water very carefully, and somehow he's able to exist for a day, 2 days, 3 days, and he's beginning to realize he ain't getting out of there. This is where he's going to be. After 5 days, he's out of water, no food, he's basically dehydrated. He takes his penknife and he etches into the wall, "Rest in peace, Aaron Ralston," and he writes the date he realized he was going to die. He didn't die. He slept that night, woke up in the morning, and something hit him in the morning. He realized that his hand was useless. His hand had been numb, there no circulation for 5 days, it was worthless anyway. But he also realized it was so numb that there was no pain. And he said to himself, if I make a tourniquet and I cut off the blood flow, I could break the arm, cut the flesh, and escape. And that's exactly what he did. He broke his arm and then began hacking through his flesh with a rusty, dull pocket knife. And he describes the pain as indescribable, searing, electric pain after pain. And finally he succeeded, walked 7 miles until he found someone who was actually camping. They immediately called for help. They called a helicopter, and he survived, and he's around to tell the story. He wrote a book called 127 Hours, which describes those events. Now, I took from that a very important lesson. Here's the question. If that were you, and an 800-pound boulder jammed your hand against the canyon wall, would you have the courage to cut off your arm to escape? Well, don't work on the question that long. I'll tell you why not. Because Aaron Ralston didn't have the courage either. You see, the first day, he went through every possibility. He thought about this, he thought about that, and that wasn't a possibility because no human being can do that. That's beyond mortal ability. But something happened after day 2 and day 3 and day 4 and finally on day 5. He realized that if he doesn't do this, he's going to die. It hit him. He really understood that life itself is over. If I don't do this, I won't be here anymore. And during those 5 days, he transformed. He became a different person. He loved life. And he had such a passion to remain alive that he did something that he never could have done 5 days ago, and something that most, maybe no other human being could. And I'd like to share with you why that's relevant to us. Mitzvah Shemit should be many days from now, many, many years from now, but at some point all of us are going to leave this earth. And I'm going to stand in front of my Creator and be richly rewarded for what I accomplished and be tremendously embarrassed for what I didn't do. And if I could ever get that moment in front of me, if I could ever get that understanding clearly in front of my eye, my life would change radically and completely. Gone would be these illusions. Gone would be these nonsensical, fanciful flights that I paint myself with. Gone would be all the marahetters. I would live a life of meaning, of passion, growing, accomplishing. And one of the greatest things that a Jew can do for themselves is on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippur, see their mortality. Read those words, Adam Yesodo Me'ofer, V'Sofo Le'ofer. Read the Yahrzeit board. Unfortunately, in this shul, it's very few. Go to an older shul, and you'll see rows and rows and rows of people. All of them came into the world. All of them left this world. And when you grip that thought that one day I won't be here. Oh, I will be here, but my body won't. I who thinks, and I, the one who feels, will stand in front of Hashem, and every action of my life will be there in vivid, total, complete clarity. And I'll be richly rewarded, tremendously proud for everything I've accomplished, and the opposite for everything I've done wrong. Getting that concept in front of me is life-changing, is galvanizing, is one of the greatest growth techniques that a person can have. May Hashem grant us a good year, a Gebench year, a year of growth, a year of accomplishment. May Hashem grant us that this will be the last year we spend in Golos.